Well, hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and I think our guest in the studio today is very much involved with the Scottish environment, and I think it's a really apposite time to have him in the studio because obviously there's been legislation changed just yesterday protecting Scotland's mountain hares. So the person going today is Peter Kearns. Hello, Peter.
Good morning, John.
Hi, thanks for coming along. And you're Executive Director of Scotland The Big Picture, and that's an environmental campaigning organisation, I guess. Tell us, what are the challenges to the Scottish environment that Scotland The Big Picture is actually addressing?
Oh, that's a big question to start off with. I think perhaps what we need to understand as a starting point, as a baseline, really, is that, and I, you know, take no pleasure in saying this at all, is that Scotland, the UK, is one of the most nature depleted nations in the world. We've lost all our large carnivores, most of our large herbivores. And if you think about it, conservation, although we are actually one of the most conservation oriented countries in the world, conservation for the last 50 years or so has concentrated really on trying to conserve individual species or fragments of habitat. Yes. And what that has brought us to, we face a global and certainly a national biodiversity crisis. So all of that approach, really, although there have been isolated successes, there's no doubt about that, but the general approach is failing. It's as simple as that. And in Scotland, despite what most people perceive as beauty and drama, and there's no doubt about it that Scotland is a spectacular country, there's no question about that, actually, when you drill it down, ecologically speaking, in terms of the abundance and diversity of nature, it's massively impoverished. So I think, you know, before we start talking about rewilding, as I'm sure we will, we need to understand the scale of dewilding that has taken place over the last 4, 5, 10 centuries. It's been a gradual process, but it's brought us to a point of crisis, really, whereby we need to do more than just trying to protect individual species or fragments and threads of habitat and start to restore and reconnect whole ecosystems. So it's a much more holistic approach to conservation.
Yeah, but I mean, most what brings people to the Highlands and what people see when they come here is a wide, wild, open expanse. What do you see is wrong with that?
Well, I think, you know, we have this almost sort of, I would say a medical condition, but we have this sort of psychological condition in the UK where we suffer from ecological blindness because we've never lived in a what I would term an ecologically rich country. We accept what we have as normal, and actually we celebrate it. We don't see the degraded landscapes and the animals we've lost because we're not conditioned to look. So on the face of it, you're absolutely right. Scotland is a country of beauty and drama. But as I say, when we drill it down ecologically, in terms of its nature enrichment, it falls massively short of the potential that it could fulfill if we give it the chance.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when I started coming to the Highlands, I was amazed at what I took to be a fantastically open and natural landscape, great sweeping hills. But what I didn't realise was that essentially you're looking at a denuded landscape where essentially the trees and the forestry have gone, and it's massively overgrazed by both red deer and sheep. And so the kind of the richness of fauna and flora that should be there, it just isn't there. In what ways is Scotland The Big Picture trying to address those kind of issues? What are your sort of central objectives then?
Well, I think if you take the word rewilding, which has really entered the mainstream in the last sort of 4 or 5 years, it has a mixed reputation, I guess. There are people that really aspire to the ethos behind it, which is a much richer, ecologically richer future, with benefits for people as well. And perhaps we'll come on to that. But equally, there are those that perceive rewilding as being synonymous with just the return of large, scary carnivores. And perhaps more importantly, crucially, they perceive that if rewilding moves in, then people have to move out. There's this perception that Scotland has to choose between nature and people, and the fear is that people are going to lose out, and that we're faced with effectively the clearance as Mark II. So part of Scotland the Big Picture's job is to reframe that narrative, to present rewilding as an opportunity, as a symbol, really, or as a pathway to a much more progressive and ambitious approach to nature conservation, whereby not only nature will benefit, climate will benefit, but just as importantly, if not more so, people can benefit. So it's a reframing exercise. And what I would say also is that it's very, very easy, I think, to fall into the temptation of pointing the finger at you know, overgrazed uplands or grouse moors or whatever. We are where we are. You know, people made choices in the past, good, bad, indifferent. It's irrelevant. It's gone. So we're very much focused on forward-looking, solutions-focused narratives that give people something to aspire to, that show that there is more potential than is presently being fulfilled, not only ecologically, but also socially, culturally, and economically.
Well, you know, you're saying that you know, that there would be opportunities for people. I mean, obviously, as you know, many rural economies are struggling these days, even more so because of the restrictions that have been brought in by, you know, the virus that we're going through right now. But how do you see that rewilding, you know, taking large areas of the Highlands, for example, away from the agricultural use and the sporting use that they've got right now, which obviously gives people a lot of, you know, a lot of income and a lot of their livelihoods. So how could that work in then, do you see, to bringing, you know, people back into the Highlands as well?
Yeah, I think, you know, the nature-based economy tends to focus on the opportunities afforded within tourism, and you know, tourism is a double-edged sword in many ways. But the sort of nature-based tourism, the ecologically minded tourism that we promote, has got huge potential. It's massively underexploited at the moment. So although tourism is not a silver bullet, there's no doubt about that. Not everybody can run a B&B or a self-catering accommodation or whatever. But there are huge potential. There is huge potential within tourism. But beyond that, if you think about the crossroads that we've arrived at now, whereby traditional land use, and by that I mean fishing, forestry, field sports and farming, traditional land use, especially in the uplands for the moment, we'll talk about the uplands, is pretty tenuous, and it exists predominantly because of public subsidy. Now, we've left the EU, rightly or wrongly, we've left the EU. And in many ways, whatever you think of that, it creates a blank canvas on which to paint a new land use regime, which is much more in keeping with the era that we move in, that we live in. And just one example of that is carbon sequestration. There's a huge movement now towards securing carbon, and some of it is the big, you know, the big multinational industrial companies like the oil companies, the airlines, that are under a legislative obligation to sequester their carbon, to offset their carbon. And in actual fact, we have a situation right now in the UK where there is more demand to sequester carbon than there is land to accommodate it. So we've got this bizarre situation where there's huge amounts of money waiting to be spent on carbon sequestration, potentially in the uplands of Scotland or anywhere else across the UK, and there's no landowner or facility to accommodate that. So that's just one example how we can turn around what is presently a pretty tenuous existence for some rural communities, and turn the opportunity for ecological restoration in partnership with carbon into an opportunity.
So carbon sequestration, then, would that I don't understand particularly how well that worked, but presumably that fits in with the preservation of peat bogs and woodlands and forestry, is that right?
Yeah, so basically, the basic model is that you have a carbon emitter, let's say an airline for the sake of argument, who has a legislative obligation to offset that their pollution, really. That's what it really comes down to. And they need to spend the money in doing that. And if you have a chunk of peatland, for example, as you suggest, that can sequester that carbon, then the airline then effectively pays the landowner to do that. The landowner is then has an obligation to effectively leave that land in its present state or in its ecologically restored state. And so it's a win-win. The airline gets the job done, the landowner gets paid, and of course society at large benefits through the sequestration of carbon. So that's just one example of how a new regime across the uplands could work. And really it's about, you know, expanding our imagination to think about what else might be possible. That's not a question of replacing traditional land uses, but it's a question of diversifying it and potentially enhancing it.
As you say, really, tourism is in many ways a double-edged sword for the, let's talk about the Highlands, because the Highlands I know best, a double-edged sword for the Highlands, because what we have done so far is try and get the world and his wife to come here, and we're now almost at the point with certainly with places like the Isle of Skye and situations like what's happening in the North Coast 500, things like that, where we're almost at saturation point in terms of what we can take. And obviously the impact of tourism is having a fairly big impact on the environment. And I think one of the issues that's happening right now is that because of the virus issue that we're having at the moment, this is making us stop and think about how we're using the environment, which is basically to exploit it, which is what we've done so far. And I noticed that places like the Isle of Mull seem to have turned things around. Things like the Sea Eagle has making really important contributions. Do you think this is you mentioned that we were at the crossroads, and that interested me. What do you see as the crossroads that we're at right now?
Well, I think more generally, we're at a crossroads where we have a global biodiversity crisis. I mean, that's not my opinion. That's now widely recognized in tandem, of course, with a climate crisis. So, you know, doing nothing, failing to reinvent ourselves, failing to scrutinize what we do and seek to improve upon that, both locally, regionally, nationally and globally, I would argue is not an option. But if we take tourism as an example, as a component of that process, then I think we all have to take responsibility for the way that we travel and the impact that we have, both negative and positive. And there's no doubt about it that nature-based tourism can be a force for good. But I would argue that in Scotland in particular, and there are just because of the infrastructure and the topography, really, that Scotland has an opportunity to secure a really rich vein of tourism, of what I would argue is discerning tourism, rather than just numbers, because numbers are going to create exactly what you've just described. So it's not about excluding people, pricing people out of the market, but I think we need a policy across Scotland that caters for tourists who are going to not only invest in their experience, but invest in the local economy as part of their travel experience. And that's, again, it's a reframing of the narrative. We've been so used to going anywhere, any time we like, doing anything and doing it for cheap, doing it on the cheap. And we've really got to examine that. And you know, Scotland, the big picture, we're really in the business of promoting inspirational journeys with impact. So yes, you go and enjoy yourself, yes, you have a fulfilling experience, but make a positive contribution to the local economy, not just in financial terms, but in terms of how you interact with the people and the landscape that you're there to enjoy.
I do think I agree with you that I think we are at a crossroads. I you know, we're beginning to see change in traditional patterns of land use that well, they've been around for all my life. That's about as far as I can remember, and they've probably been around for a few hundred years. And there was legislation yesterday in the Scottish Parliament that made the mountain hare a protected species. And I think that's a massive step forward. Well, what's your view about what happened in the Scottish Parliament yesterday?
Yeah, I think it's very easy, and we see a lot of it on social media of bashing grouse moors or grouse moor owners, and you know, it doesn't work. It doesn't have any effect. So I'm not here to criticise the way land managers utilise their land. Having said that, you know, I always sort of try and take an objective and a fair perspective on this. If let's just hypothetically suggest that grouse moors had never existed. If you came along today in 2020 and suggested grouse moors and their associated management practices as a sustainable and socially just land use for the Scottish uplands, you'd get laughed at. You would be laughed out of court for all manner of reasons, and mountain hares are just one of them. So, but here we are, protecting them, not only protecting them, but in some cases celebrating them, and in many, many cases subsidizing them. So to me, it doesn't make sense. And so, you know, the legislation that protected mountain hares that was passed yesterday is welcome, certainly, but it should have happened years ago. It really should have happened years ago. The concept of expelling huge populations of a given species. Yeah. For the benefit of what some would perceive a privileged pursuit, you know, to effectively killing one animal in order to allow a few people to kill more animals in 2020. Is that the sort of country we want to live in? And is that the sort of message that we want to send out to the rest of the world? I don't think so. In a socially just and progressive society, I don't think that it fits anymore. So,
no,
you know, the mountain hare issue is a welcome cog in the mechanism, if you like, but it is only one small cog. And I think we have to look at land use in the round. How do we make it sustainable and beneficial to as wide a sector of society as we can? And if we think that grouse moor management doesn't do that, then I think we have to have a conversation with ourselves about what other options are available.
To be honest, I'm an unrepentant grouse moor badger. I'm not particularly. I don't see much in that model of land management to actually, you know, benefit anybody really. Things are shifting. I mean, to be honest, I do hope that the protection of the mounted hare is a nail in the coffin. Driven grouse moor, but also I think what's happening at the moment is that there's an economic shift. As you know, money drives a lot of things, and I think it seems to me that what we're seeing at the moment is an economic shift away from the more traditional land management models that we've had, more towards an ecological model. As that becomes more profitable, essentially, is that what you see happening?
Yeah, very much so. And I think, you know, the canny landowners, and I'm not just talking about the big, you know, the big grouse moor owners, farmers, crofters, the canny land managers are looking at the horizon, and they might not like what they see coming. But the fact is that change is coming. Society will demand that change is effected, and it may well be reflected in the new subsidy system as that evolves. So the canny landowners are looking to the future and thinking, you know, I might not like the look of it, but I can't just sit here and bury my head in the sand and assume that all is well, because that's just not an option. They'll go out of business. And I had a call actually from a friend of mine that works at one of the big estate agents that handle a lot of big estate sales, and he told me that six out of the last seven purchasers of Scottish estates, which, you know, even 3 years ago would have all been for traditional sporting reasons, were for ecological investment. Yes. Now that could be a whole range of it. Could be a wind farm for all I know, but the chances are that within that there are people buying it for the opportunities afforded for ecological restoration. Now that, again, that might be carbon, it might be biodiversity, it might be a whole range of things, but people are thinking differently about why they are acquiring these huge tracts of land, and for me that's got to be welcome.
Oh, yeah. I'm hearing that change, and I think it is moving us in a different direction. I mean, one of the success stories, I mean, of recent years in terms of rewilding, it's just a first step, really, has been the reintroduction of the beaver, which is obviously the first land mammal to be reintroduced. I think it's been extinct for something like 400 years in the British Isles. It's inevitably meant that an animal like a beaver, which is one of the few animals that actually sort of engineers its own environment in terms of damming rivers and changing the landscape, has come into conflict with farming interests. Where do you think we are with the reintroduction of the beaver right now? And where would you like to see that going?
Yeah, I mean, the beavers, I would argue that whether we're talking about seagulls or lynx or beavers or pine martens or grouse or whatever, you know, this debate, if you want to call it a debate or discussion, is actually not about the animals. It's not about the ecological elements. And we know how to rewild landscapes. We know how to restore forests. We know how to rejuvenate peatlands. This whole arena is now about people and their value systems and their belief systems and their priorities and motivations. So it's all about hearts and minds, and beavers are absolutely no different. So yeah, again, it's easy to sort of pick over the last 3 or 4 years of history and look at the Tayside situation and the so-called illegal beavers. But, you know, again, there's no point in going over old ground. They are there, and they are causing some concerns with farming interests. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
I think from my point of view, the frustration that is very much now, because there was a letter that went to the Cabinet Secretary just last week, is that there is an option to killing them. So at the moment, as you're probably aware, farmers have the ability to mitigate the damage or impact of beavers on farmland through a whole range of mechanisms, and one of those mechanisms is to shoot them. And and you know, the headline at the moment going around is that 20% of the beaver population in and around the Tayside catchment have been shot. Putting the rights and wrongs of that aside for a moment, there's an alternative. There's an alternative in moving them rather than shooting them. And there are landowners across Scotland in less, shall we say, sensitive areas where agriculture is not such a dominant land use that are willing, that are keen to adopt beavers. And again, the practice is proven. Already, Scottish beavers that are, in inverted commas, a problem have been effectively exported down to England for flood mitigation trials down there. So it can be done. It's a very standard practice. So why, rather than shooting them, aren't we just translocating them to somewhere where they're welcome and can do some good? So this, to me, is symptomatic of a government. It's not just the government. It's a societal mindset, really, that really needs to stretch its imagination and become a little bit more ambitious and innovative in its thinking against the backdrop of that global biodiversity crisis. You can't, on the one hand, say, here we are in a global biodiversity crisis. Scotland wants to play a leading role in addressing that, so to speak. And yet we have this blind spot whereby, you know, the Cabinet Secretary has made a promise to the farming community, and understandably, I get that, but here's an opportunity to keep the farming community happy and also to allow the natural recolonization of beavers. Why wouldn't you take that win-win option? So again, for me, it smacks of ecological blindness and a lack of ambition. So it's disappointing and frustrating that option isn't being taken at the moment.
I mean, I can understand where you're coming from, but it is a debate that or a discussion that's been going on for a long time. And the issue, as I understand it, essentially is that beavers escaped or were in reintroduced one way or another into the River Tay. The River Tay is Scotland's longest river, and once beavers get into the Tay, they've got carte blanche. They can move all over the place and cover a very wide area. And the issue that occurred, as far as I understand, is obviously that's also on the floodplains of the Tay, is some of the richest agricultural land around. And beavers being beavers, and this land being flat, decide to flood that, and that obviously leads them into conflict. And there's a choice at that point, I guess, and there's probably lots of other ways of dealing with it, between moving the beavers somewhere else and shooting them. And licenses have been given, and as you say, about 80, more than 80, 90 beavers, I believe, have been shot. But the issue is, we kind of have to grow food somewhere. And that's our best farmland. And one of the things about the introduction of the beaver is that it almost uniquely, there has been a sort of consensus amongst environmental bodies, the farming community and other local interests to sort of agree a way of introducing the beaver. And the challenge I see about, I mean, you know, I'd like beaver everywhere, but the challenge of translocation is that, as you know, you can't really introduce a beaver into a very small area. If you put them in the spay, for example, they will spread throughout that area, and you risk kind of breaking down the consensus we've got. Does that make sense? What do you think of that argument?
Yeah, it does make sense, and I get it. Don't get me wrong. I hope I'm a bit of a pragmatist, so I do understand it. But here's a scenario. Again, for me, it's not about necessarily dwelling on the problems. It's thinking about the solutions. So what options are available to us? There is valuable farmland being impacted by beavers, and on the flip side of that, there are, you know, the vast majority of people in Scotland want beavers. So how do you reconcile those two seemingly opposing agendas? In Germany, this is how they deal with it. It is a requirement that all watercourses have a 5-meter buffer strip either side of that watercourse. Now, that's not specifically for beavers. That's to aid, you know, wildlife migration, wildlife corridors, reconnecting ecological networks, et cetera, et cetera. So has a whole range of benefits beyond just accommodating beavers. And what the German government do, of course, quite sensibly, in my opinion, is pay the farmers for that, for giving up that buffer zone, basically. So rather than being obsessed with maximizing food production right up to the edge of every border, every boundary, including watercourses, why don't we think more imaginatively about it? How can we arrive at a situation where the farmer is not financially disadvantaged or inconvenienced by the presence of beavers, but beavers and a whole range of other wildlife and the benefits that beavers bring are allowed to spread? It's a win-win situation. So there you have a model, a proven model that exists and that works and that would be easy for us to adopt if we had the political will to do so.
Yeah, I think that what you've made at that point about the political will is important, because it's I'm not going to get into the issue of land management and who decides what, but one of the great sort of anachronisms of Scotland, what left over from history, I guess, is that we have a land ownership system where a small percentage of the population own vast areas of the landscape, and in many ways can decide what happens there. And it's that move to change. You're right, you can't look at one species in isolation, because how one species interacts with another and how the overall landscape and the environment interact, it's all one big system. I spoke a while ago to David Hetherington about his book The Lynx and Us, and you know, we've reintroduced the beaver, and that discussion is still ongoing, really. Where do you think that we are with the reintroduction of one of the big challenges is a carnivore? Where do you think we are with that debate at the moment?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me just very quickly go back to a word that you used, and that word is system. So I'm always a little bit reluctant to tease out one individual species, whether it's mountain hare, beaver, seagull, lynx, whatever, because it is the system. How do we ensure the system functions as optimally as possible? But put that aside for a moment. So lynx is a component within the system, but there are, you know, thousands and thousands of other components within the system as well. But if we take lynx, again, physically, we know how to move lynx. We, you know, ecologically speaking, there is habitat, there is prey, and we know how to do it. So if there was public and political will, we could do it tomorrow and lynx would prosper in Scotland, no yeah. problem. But the barrier, as you rightly allude to, is a social and political barrier. So all I can say is that the conversation has been going around for many, many years. There is significant anecdotal evidence to suggest that the Scottish population at large is in favour of reintroduction. Now, we could dissect that forever, but the fact is we don't know. And we actually have just are on the brink of launching an isolated standalone project to answer that question, to carry out a social feasibility study across a wide range of public interest groups, including obviously the stakeholders like farmers, keepers, etc., etc., to establish definitively with an evidence base whether there is an appetite in Scotland for the return of lynx or not, as the case may be. And if it's not, you know, people like me have to be prepared to walk away and say, yeah. hands up, Scotland is not yet ready. Let's put it away for a while at least. So, but until that work is done, and it's a requirement as part of a reintroduction, a legal requirement as part of a reintroduction, until that work is done, we're hypothesizing about, you know, who would think what, why, and when. Because we don't know. There'll be people, there'll be detractors, and there'll be people in favour, of course, and everything in between. But until we can put some evidence against that, we don't know whether Scotland is ready for lynx or not.
It's been fascinating talking to you. I mean, a lot of these issues are pretty complex, but I, like you, I think we are beginning to see change. We've had the reintroduction of beavers. We've got protection of mountain hare, and there seems to be an economic shift away from the kind of sporting estates which have dominated our environment for so long. And if people wanted to get involved with the Scotland the Big Picture and you know, find out more about your work, what could they do?
Yeah, so the website is scotlandbigpicture.com, no punctuation. We have a community with what we call Think Like a Mountain. You can join our journey. We'd be delighted if you do so. We're very active on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram. So yeah, we'd be delighted if folk follow us and get involved. It's a fascinating and very quickly evolving story around rewilding, and you know, just very quickly to return to your point earlier, John, this is all about people. This is all about the conversations that take place between different people and different communities of people. It's all about people's values and belief systems. So we could argue all day whether about, you know, how many lynx could live in a given yeah. area, blah blah. It's yeah. all comes down to people's attitudes, and that's really what we deal with on a daily basis, and trying to turn rewilding from a perceived threat into a genuine opportunity.
Peter, thanks very much for talking to me, and I wish you all the best for your work. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for your time.
Okay, bye-bye then. Some fascinating stuff there from Peter Kearns about, you know, the Scottish environment, which is very much at the crossroads right now. Just to let you know that I've got a couple of really exciting podcasts coming up soon. I'll be talking to Simon McCartney, who wrote the award-winning book, The Bond. It's a really gripping book. I've been reading it recently. It's about his exploits in Alaska, and includes an ascent, a winter ascent of the north face of the Eiger. Pretty gripping stuff, I have to say. I'll also be talking to Heather Morning, because we'll be all right now. I'm recording this on the 18th of June, 2020. And in Scotland, we'll be looking at, I think, going into phase two of our emergence from lockdown. So for the outdoor community, that may well, I would hope, have some fairly significant information there from Heather about where we're going, what we're going to do, and what you'll be able to do over the next few weeks in the Scottish outdoors. So those are two interesting podcasts coming up. I've been John Burns. I really hope you've enjoyed listening to me, and keep safe, take care, and I'll speak to you soon. Bye-bye.